folks. This is a fundraising pitch. You might have noticed that the show's been on hiatus for about the last 6 months. Okay, why? Well, I've been producing The Koreafile ad-free for the last 3 years. That's 68 episodes. And it takes a lot of time and effort to track down interviews, research, edit, and produce the show. Of course, I gotta work to pay the rent, which doesn't leave a lot of time to focus on the podcast. So I'm wondering, is it possible to turn this into a part-time job? Maybe, but I need your help. Go to patreon.com/thekoreafile and throw me a few dollars a month. For the price of a cup of coffee at Tom and Tom's, for the cost of a sandwich at Isaac Toast, you can help turn this podcast into a sustainable project. And patrons get perks. For an ongoing donation of just $4 a month, you'll have access to extra content that you won't find anywhere else online, including bonus interviews and special subscriber-only episodes. If you can afford to contribute a little more every month, $10 donation gets you exclusive VIP access to information about upcoming guests and the opportunity to submit questions for future episodes, a kind of executive producer position. But hey, every dollar helps a lot, and listeners like you can help to sustain this podcast. So if you can contribute, again, go to patreon.com/thekoreafile and donate a few bucks. Thanks. All right. Here's the episode. Broadcasting from Ann Arbor, this is The Koreafile, a biweekly podcast about music, culture, and society from around the Korean Peninsula and the world. I'm Andre Goulet. On this episode... Joshua Van Loo is a historian of 20th century East Asian politics and international relations and an authority on the histories of Joseon Korea and late imperial China. In this conversation, Van Loo discusses the diplomatic intrigue of the Qing-Korea relationship and explains how the pageantry of tributary practice successfully manipulated Western preconceptions of an unknowable Orient. This episode was produced in collaboration with the University of Michigan's Nam Center for Korean Studies. So Joshua, what is tributary practice?
Well, tributary practice is a term that I use in contradistinction to tributary system. So if we think about interstate relations in East Asia prior to the 20th century, many states engaged primarily with either the Qing Empire or the Ming Empire through what we call a tributary relationship, in which, say, a country like Joseon acknowledged the superiority of the Qing state, for example, and did so through a series of protocols that involved sending missions to Beijing to submit tribute. And to submit, various, say, for example, letters of congratulations, say, for imperial birthdays or presenting gifts to members of the imperial family and things of that nature. The Qing government might do things such as send the calendar each year, because the Joseon state actually used the Qing imperial calendar. Also to provide investiture to the Joseon royal family, so to the princes, the kings, and whatnot.
Investiture means?
To provide actually a title, so that the King of Korea received his title from the Qing throne or from the Ming throne. So they would get a patent of investiture. He would get a seal that would say, I'm the king, right? And also, which is something that's relevant for the work that I'll be talking about today, is that when a member of the royal family died, there would be a special mission sent to offer condolences.
So this was essentially a form of interstate relations or diplomatic relations.
Mm-hmm.
Today, it's completely different. I mean, nobody is paying tribute to a more powerful nation, or right. Are they?
Well, theoretically, what's going on in the tributary relationship is you have a fundamentally hierarchical relationship, right? And what, say, the Qing throne would have gotten from this is essentially a friendly neighbor. And what the Joseon throne got from this was protection. So, as long as Joseon acknowledged the superiority of the Qing state, then the Qing was responsible essentially for Joseon's security. Now, at least putatively, we live in what we would call a Westphalian system, in which you have a system of equally sovereign states. Now, whether or not that's really true, right, is another question. And we can actually ask the same question about a tributary system, too. Was it really the case that you always had, say, a single Chinese hegemon that was utterly dominant over kind of a supine, you know, set of neighbors around East Asia or Southeast Asia? And, you know, just we can ask the same question about a Westphalian system. And, yeah, we say, right, that we have an international system that's characterized by equal sovereignty. But if you look at the way in which states interact now, you know, you might actually ask the question about, well, maybe do we look at, say, like China and client states, United States and client states. And,
which includes South Korea. So, I'm yeah, one, like, the other client-state relationship, probably South Korea doesn't like to think of itself that way, but in terms of appreciating the military support. But this is not tributary.
It's not, although there have been some, actually, South Korean writers who have characterized the relationship with the United States as akin to a tributary relationship. So that idea is out there. It's in circulation.
So Korea's tributary relationship with the Qing dynasty?
That's right.
Right, existed right up until the collapse of the dynasty in 1912. So this relationship lasted hundreds of years, right?
Well, actually, it was over in 1895.
Okay.
So the relationship started in 1637, and at least with Qing, and ended in 1895. Although there was an attempt in 1899 where the Qing tried to reinstate the relationship, but that never happened. So, yeah, from 1637 to 1895.
Tell us more about this relationship, this Qing-Chosun relationship.
Well, in the 1630s, actually, the Qing Empire imposed it upon Korea. So, you know, if we look at the period of, you know, the early 1600s, even, like, say, from the 1590s up through the 1630s, 1640s, we have a crumbling Ming Empire and a rising you know, Manchu Empire. The term Qing comes a little bit later. And there's actually, so there have been some interesting work among Korean historians dealing with the ways in which the Joseon state was trying to figure out, do we remain loyal to the Ming, or should we throw our lot in with the rising Qing? The Gwanghaegun, some people call him now King Gwanghae, was you know, a Joseon ruler in the early 1600s who decided really that the future lay with the Qing, but he had to constantly fight his own government actually to try to establish friendly relations with the Qing at the expense of the Ming. But finally, actually, you know, the Ming collapsed, and also, you know, King Gwanghae was dethroned, you know, in no small part because of his unwillingness to maintain the relationship with the Ming. And so through the 1630s, 1640s, 50s, and 60s, the relationship at that point was really a coercive one. And actually, there were a succession of Joseon kings that were kind of nursing the fantasy of one day avenging, you know, this coerced relationship. And, you know, in 1626 and 1636, the Qing actually invaded Joseon in both occasions, really, to try to enforce Joseon's submission. But later on, though, I think especially we get into the 1700s and the early 1800s, the relationship is quite stable and normalized.
Fast forwarding then to the late 19th century, one of the big moments in the twilight of this relationship was the Qing condolence mission sent to Korea in the wake of the death of Queen Dowager Cho in 1890. Who was Queen Dowager Cho, and why was her death so momentous?
Well, Queen Dowager Cho, she had been the queen to King Ikjong. Now, if you look at the list of Joseon kings, you're not going to find a King Ikjong, and that's because actually he died before he came to the throne. But he, you know, she was you know, mother and grandmother to the next two kings, to Hanchong and Chulchong. And when King Chulchong died in 1863, there was no heir right away. And what happens in a situation like that is that the Queen Dowager becomes regent. And she was quite a forceful woman politically. And the story goes, actually, that upon the death of the king, that she snatched up the royal seals and then hid them in her skirts and ran off with them to make sure that she had the authority. But in 1864, with the establishment of the Taewongun's regency, at first they had a co-regency, but he was able to push her out. But even so, through the 1860s all the way till her death, and arguably even before, she was politically very influential. And in particular, she was said to control the appointment of governors to Hwanghae province, and that apparently she also kind of had a straw, shall we say, in the tax revenues of Hwanghae province that she used for her own use. One of the problems, actually, in doing research on female political figures in the Joseon court is that the source materials that survive are largely silent. Yeah, so she is almost invisible in any kind of official documentation. So the only thing way that I know about what I'm telling you right now is through people's diaries and the sort of the yasa, these unofficial histories. So I can't give you a real careful accounting of exactly what her power was like, but I can tell you certainly her reputation. But King Kojong in particular was closely allied with her, especially since when the Taewongun was deposed, she was a natural ally for when King Kojong assumed personal rule. And domestically speaking, when she died, King Kojong actually was quite concerned that there would be an assassination. It would be an attempt on his life, and that perhaps the Taewongun would see her death as an opportunity to try to reinstate his power. But internationally, her death itself is not the issue. The issue was the condolence mission and the ways in which the Joseon state and Qing representatives attempted to harness both the state funeral and this condolence mission to engage in this kind of political theater that I've written about.
Right, the condolence mission and the diplomatic events surrounding it became a kind of battleground mm-hmm. in which the governments of Joseon Korea, the Qing Empire of China, and the United States were vying with one another to define the nature of the sovereignty of Joseon and Qing imperial authority through differing historical interpretations of the relationship. Mm-hmm. So unpack that for us a little bit.
Well, actually, there was a change in Qing policy towards Joseon in the early 1880s, and potentially even now we can trace it back maybe to the late 1870s, in which Li Hongzhang in particular and his staff, Li Hongzhang, he was the commissioner for northern ports and based in Tianjin at this time, and he was placed in control of Qing Joseon policy, and he felt that the tributary relationship was no longer going to really suffice in a rapidly changing geopolitical situation. You think about the coming of Western powers and whatnot, that this was no longer going to defend Joseon or maintain Qing interests in Joseon. So he began to suggest, actually through various channels to the Joseon government, that it was time to revamp this relationship and to kind of modernize it, I suppose, in a way. Although I don't really like to use the word modernize, but to change the relationship such that both Qing and Joseon could meet sort of more contemporary security needs. And so part of this was going to be actually to get rid of the tributary relationship and come up with what I kind of think of as like a hierarchical yet more cooperative partnership, sort of for mutual security. And so actually Li Hongzhang, through some of his surrogates, proposed this plan to King Kojong. I'll be talking about this some in the paper today. And Kojong was very enthusiastic about it, and after very violently suppressing some domestic resistance to this plan, he sent an envoy to Beijing and to Tianjin to speak with the Qing government. But by the time, this took about a year from the time he received the proposals to the time he proposed changes on his own, there had been something of a change of heart within the Qing government, and they refused him. And in particular, it was the Qing Board of Rights that said, no, we can't just do away with the tributary protocols, and here's why. We have to make sure that the international diplomatic community understands that we have a special relationship with Joseon that nobody else has. And the only way that we can really do that is by preserving these tributary protocols and making sure that these protocols are visible to the Western diplomatic community.
Did this fear come from a point of weakness that the Qing dynasty was feeling at the time?
Yes, actually, for a long time in the second half of the 19th century and even earlier, strategic thinkers in Qing and Joseon and even the Tokugawa government in Japan were all very concerned about Russia and Russian expansion. And actually in 1860, I guess, was the Russians annexed what are now the Russian maritime provinces from the Qing Empire. So the fear was really quite real and well-founded.
So the confrontations revolved around, as you're saying, a keen awareness and manipulation of mm-hmm. the Western preconceptions of the unknowable, the mysterious, the strange Orient. And it resulted in a piece of international political theater. Mm. So what did this look like to Western eyes?
Well, the theater itself is, both Qing participation in the state funeral, which actually did not go well for Qing. The Joseon government was pretty good in managing to thwart Qing manipulation of the state funeral. But when it came time, though, for the Qing envoys to arrive, then in that case, the Joseon government was unable to stop that. And the reason that I call this an international political theater is because at that time, by 1890, there was already a significant international community in Incheon, or Jaemulpo, where the Qing officers landed, and then also in Seoul as well. And there had been a tremendous argument over the course of about 5 months in which the Joseon government tried to stop any of the public rituals from occurring, and the Qing government kept insisting that the rituals would go forward. And the key ritual to this was that when the Qing envoys arrived outside of Seoul, that King Kojong would go out and publicly perform a prostration before the imperial letter of condolence. And that was the key thing that actually the king was trying to prevent. And he was unable to. And so what happened afterwards was that there was kind of a flurry of Western activity, commentarial activity. I said, what happened? What did this mean? The U.S. legation, the Augustine Heard, who was the U.S. minister at that time, was actually kind of confused by it because he had actually been quite active in helping the Joseon government to thwart Yuan Shikai's participation in the state funeral. So when they saw that King Kojong seemed to completely acquiesce, Augustine Heard couldn't figure that out. And that's actually where the title of my paper comes from, that when Augustine Heard was writing a report back to President Harrison about what he had seen, he said that the act was oriental between orientals, and really as such that it was kind of fundamentally unknowable. The argument that he made is that, look, it does look like Joseon has just submitted to Qing, but that's not really what this is about. It's just a kind of an empty ritual that people do. We really should not interpret it as being too terribly meaningful, and we should not worry that we have signed a treaty with a state that has no sovereignty.
The title of your talk at the NAM Center's colloquium series is, quote, "The Act Was Oriental Between Orientals," end quote, "The Persistence of Late Victorian Translations of the Twilight of Qing Joseon Tributary Practice." So the West's interpretation of the event was shaped by Western scholarship and perspective on Joseon-Qing interactions and their notion of tributary relationships. So my question is, do we still see those interpretations playing out today?
I would say absolutely yes. And actually, right after the condolence mission, the Yuan Shikai actually produced an English language pamphlet to be distributed to the Western diplomatic community that gave a Qing spin on what had happened. And that pamphlet was picked up by Nathaniel Curzon and relied upon it in a very, very successful book he wrote in 1894 called Problems of the Far East. And this book talked about a kind of a willing Joseon submission to Qing authority as part of this kind of ancient East Asian practice. And that book got picked up through a number of publications through the late 19th century, in the early 20th century, and actually even into the 21st century, there have been some monographs that have been quoting this material. So you can find actually that this there's a genealogy to this understanding of tribute. But in the field of international relations, there have recently been several books. Most notably, a book called East Asia Before the West by David Kang, that has kind of revived this notion of a unitary tributary system that we can use as a kind of an objective optic to understand East Asian state relations. And moreover, kind of a formula that we could use, well, formula is a little strong, but it's maybe a set of practices that we could use to think about the ways in which the People's Republic of China actually conducts itself on the world stage now. I say the word revive or reintroduce because among China historians in particular, and I would say far less so Korean historians, I think have not been so good at being critical about the tributary relationship, but China historians have been, I think, quite good in really taking apart the idea that there was even a tributary system at all. And so for historians of East Asia, it's been a real jolt, actually, to see this model come back in and really be, I think, accepted broadly among IR scholars.
IR.
International relations. IR is usually the term used for the academic pursuit of studying international relations. So international relations being the relations itself and IR being the field.
You talked before about fear of Russia at the time, but this was also just prior to the point where Japan basically gutted the entire region. China was to change dramatically in the very near future, and of course Korea was to be occupied for 40 years. How was the relationship between Korea and China at that time impacted by a threat of a rising Japan? Did they see it coming?
I think primarily my work really concentrates on the 1880s. And I think at that point, you don't really see as much discussion of Japan as a threat as you might in the 1890s or the early 1900s.
Was Japan aware that it wanted to be a threat at that point?
There have been some arguments, actually, that Japan did not really have an imperialist sort of plan of action until the 1890s. Actually goes back, I guess, to Hilary Conroy, who published a work on this in the early, I guess, 1960. You'll find other people who say that they were planning it all along. We can actually kind of look at a certain kind of Japanese expansionism going back to the 1870s. But I think for the most part, if you look at most scholars of Japanese imperialism, they really don't date the beginning of that in earnest until 1894-95. But you know, in my experience and the source materials that I've worked with, Japan doesn't come up often, which I've actually found interesting. I mean, even with the whole event of Queen Dowager Jo's death, I found very little reference to or concern about what the Japanese diplomatic presence thought about this. And even going through Japanese diplomatic communications, there wasn't a lot. I couldn't find very much interest in it. It is true, actually, that the Japanese wanted to also participate in the state funeral, and they threatened to close their embassy if they were not allowed. But actually, again, in the source materials that I've had access to, I only found that threat. I never found any more about it. So certainly, I think Qing policymakers were definitely thinking about rising Japan as a potential threat, at least in 1890. But if you think about it, though, Japanese influence in Joseon from about 1885 up through the early 1890s was really at a low ebb. Because there had been Japanese agents who were involved in the 1884 coup. And part of the reason actually that the Qing had such an ascendant position in Joseon at that time is that there was a military intervention involved in chasing out actually the Japanese the Japanese agents and those Koreans who had cooperated with them during the coup of 1884. So for a little while, I think Japan was really lying low during the mid to late 1880s, and I don't think we really see a resurgence of Japanese, at least economic interests, let alone political interests, until we get into the 1890s. I do think that it's a legitimate criticism of my work that I don't really spend much time talking about Japan, but on the other hand, I think for the particular time period that I'm talking about, they are not as central to the question, really.
One of your current projects concerns the transnational politics of translation in late 19th century Korea and China. Tell us about this research.
Okay, well, I've long been interested, actually, in a text that in English, I guess, we translate as The History of the Fall of Vietnam. It was written partially by a Vietnamese nationalist activist named Phan Bo Châu. Those writings were compiled and edited and added to by Liang Qichao, who's a late Qing and early Republic, I guess, historian and also political activist as well in China, or in Qing and in the Republic. This book came out in 1905. And very, very quickly, it was all over Korea. So between 1906 and 1909, it went through three different Korean vernacular translations, because the original text was in literary Chinese. And each one of those translations is actually quite different in terms of content and style. And the translations at this time are in many ways actually kind of more like a selective rephrasing of things. It's not quite translation in the way that we might think of it in terms of trying to find exact equivalencies. And actually, the book was so popular that the Japanese authorities in 1909 banned it. And the content of the book, generally speaking, is a call to essentially to nations that are in danger of being colonized, that they should really develop a sense of national pride and national identity as a way of resisting foreign domination. And so this Phan from Vietnam, the story really is about how it is that the French were able to take Vietnam, and why it is that the Vietnamese were never able to sort of rise up and resist this kind of invasion. And so if you think about 1905, 1906, this is right before Joseon, or I guess at this point the Great Han Empire, right, is annexed into the Japanese Empire. So it was really timely and enormously popular and very widely read in the Han Empire at that time. I'm interested, actually, though, in looking at this more than just a call to, to people to cultivate their national identity to resist foreign oppression. What's going on in this text, actually, I think, is a bit deeper, in that it is a kind of a reassessment and a realignment of historical consciousness, and looking at where Korea falls in world history. So the text is kind of interesting in that it not only refers to sometimes, you know, older Chinese historical precedent, which would have been quite normal, right, for Korean texts, but it also refers to a whole variety of colonial expansions in the 19th century world. And so in a way, it's a repositioning of Korea in the world. So you know, prior, we might think about a historical consciousness that embodies largely China and its immediate neighbors. But as we're moving now into the early 20th century through this particular translation, there is a kind of a retuning and a re-understanding of what constitutes relevant world history and where Korea fits in that. What I'm also finding interesting, too, is that this text is circulating not only, you know, among private citizens, as it were, but it comes up a lot now in official documents, the text or the notion of Vietnam as a cautionary tale. So I'm also interested in looking at not only how, you know, popular notions of national identity and resistance, you know, anti-colonial resistance, but also seeing how these ideas are circulating in official circles as well.
Joshua Van Loo is Assistant Professor of History and Curriculum Director of the Asian Studies Program at LaGrange College. Joshua, thanks for speaking with the Korea File.
Always a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's the Korea File for this week. To see Joshua Van Loo's full lecture, look for The Act Was Oriental Between Orientals, The Persistence of Late Victorian Translations of the Twilight of Ching Chosun Tributary Practice on YouTube. While you're there, subscribe to the NAM Center's YouTube channel at UMichNCKS. That's UMICHNCKS. You can subscribe to the Korea File podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and Blog Talk Radio, and you can find us as a featured contributor at KoreaFM.net, KoreaBridge.net, and Anglo Info Seoul. Find them and like them on Facebook. You can find the Korea File there too, and on Twitter at the Korea File, with daily links and current news and commentary about the peninsula. And take a minute to leave a review of this podcast wherever you subscribe. It'll help new listeners discover the show. Until next time, thanks for listening. From Ann Arbor, I'm Andre Goulet.